Today's episode features a conversation with Dr. Paula Swindell, an experienced scholar and practitioner with a PhD in psychology and a long history of working with survivors of spiritual trauma and abuse. She brings a rare and necessary combination of academic expertise and pastoral sensitivity to the conversation. Dr. Swindell has spent years studying the intersection of religion, power, and psychological harm. In our conversation, she helps unpack some of the deeper dynamics at play with systems like Vineyard USA, from spiritual bypassing and toxic positivity to the psychological toll of betrayal by trusted leaders. This interview is essential listening for anyone trying to make sense of how movements that begin with good intentions can cause such lasting harm, and how to begin the long, difficult road toward healing and accountability. This is my full conversation with Dr. Paula Swindell. All right. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming on, Dr. Paula Swindell. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your afternoon.
Yeah. Excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. This is a topic that we've talked about a little bit, you know, on my other podcast, The Deconstructionist. But really, I brought you here today to talk about two more specific incidents where the allegations are oddly similar. And so we'll get into a little bit about that. But before we dive too much into it, tell people a little bit about your background and what led you to focus your work on religious and spiritual abuse?
Yeah, so I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor and supervisor in the state of North Carolina. I've been doing counseling work for 25 years now. It kind of pains me to say that, but that is true. And after doing counseling work in a lot of different settings, I've worked in private practice, I've worked in hospitals, I've worked in addictions work, I've done just a little bit of everything, youth and family therapy and agencies. And one of the things that counselors are taught is that we should be assessing for aspects of identity, and one of those aspects being someone's spiritual or religious worldview and background, and respecting that and bringing it into the counseling process if clients felt like that would be helpful. And I feel like my training did a pretty decent job of, if there had been a positive experience with someone's religion or spirituality, how we could use that ethically, but was not taught really anything about people who had had harmful experiences as part of their religious experiences. So when I had been practicing as a counselor for about 14, 15 years, I went back to get my PhD in order to pivot to the academic world and teach counselors. And I'm now an associate professor and department chair of a counseling program at a university. And so you know, as part of your PhD, you have to do a dissertation, and they say to do it on something you're passionate about. And so I had heard in all of those different counseling settings, you know, people describing their spiritual lives and heard instances of harm. And I would notice in myself kind of this reaction of maybe wanting to defend God or defend religion and say, that's not everybody. That's not, you know, that's not every church, but that's not my role as a counselor at all. And so when it came time to do a dissertation, I thought, I really want to help counselors understand this experience of someone who's been harmed in a religious system. And so that's where it started, was my dissertation. And then it kind of became a lot of my academic work. I've continued doing some research on it. I currently teach an elective at the university where I teach on religious trauma. I opened a small private practice that's called the Center for Healing Religious Harm and focus all of my private practice work in that area. I've written a textbook with some colleagues around teaching counselors how to deal with that. So that's a little bit of my personal experience. I personally have had really positive experiences in religion. And but it's been really helpful for me to be able to look at the other perspective and to provide a healing space for clients.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a fascinating background and way to sort of find yourself in that particular space. So that's really cool. So thank you for sharing that. In your view, how does spiritual abuse differ from other forms of psychological or emotional abuse?
Love that question, because that was actually really the question that was underneath my dissertation. When I was working on my dissertation, for starting at about 10 years ago, there wasn't a lot of research about that. There's a lot of interest in the topic. There's a lot of people who have opinions. When you say spiritual abuse, religious trauma, all these different terms we use for this, people always have an idea of what you're talking about. People always go, oh, and have a reaction to it. But figuring out what it actually is has actually been much harder, much more difficult to define things. So what I was really curious about is what happens when that sacred element is a part of someone's abuse experience, because we know that physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, financial abuse, all the different types of abuse that are out there follow a specific pattern and have dynamics of power and control. And so I was really curious to see what would happen when that element of the sacred was introduced there. And so that's what I would say is the main difference. There's a lot of differences. I could talk a long time about this, but the main difference is when that aspect of spirituality or the sacred is infused into this experience, the power dynamics are amplified in massive ways. You know, for people who believe in God, there is nothing more powerful than God. And so when the abuser says, well, God's on my side, and, you know, God, this is what God says, and this is what God told me to tell you, you know, it's really, the power dynamics there are really hard to argue with sometimes.
Yeah. And we'll definitely get into that, because there's definitely elements of that in both of the cases that we've talked about throughout this podcast series. So tell people a little bit of what are some of the most common signs of spiritual abuse that people often miss or dismiss?
So some of my research has looked at, like, what are the common experiences? And maybe even to take a step back, one of the things that I've done is try to break it down into three categories of who is doing the abusing. And I think this really speaks to this series that you're doing as well, John, that that people can have an experience that might fall into all three of these categories, but really looking at who the perpetrator is. So it might be a religious leader, someone who's, you know, has a formal leadership role. It might be the system. So the group might be the abuser. It might be the theology or the belief system that's putting that forward. And so someone can have an experience that fits into all three of those. But some of the most common experiences, and I'm not sure if this is exactly answering your question about signs, but some of the most common experiences are, of course, emotional trauma of the reaction to that. But the things that I hear most commonly are feelings of betrayal, where they really feel like this was the place that was supposed to be safe. This was the place that was supposed to protect me. Literally, the building's called Sanctuary. It's supposed to be that. So all of these supposed to be things, and that's the definition of betrayal. When you're harmed by someone you trusted, it's one thing to be harmed and then to be harmed by someone you trusted. So those feelings of betrayal are a really huge part of where it comes into these experiences. We also see these experiences of people who feel like the rules are more important than the people. So that rigidity around the rules, I see you nodding. Jump in here anytime if you have thoughts.
This is right on target, I think.
Okay, good. So, you know, there's just such a dehumanizing experience when someone's, like, for example, several of the women in my dissertation study were having experiences of domestic violence and from their husbands and had gone to their churches to try to seek support around that, with churches choosing the abusive spouse over them because they were doing the, quote, right thing and wanting to stay married and work it out. And so the message that was sent there was very much this rule that you stay married no matter what was more important than your literal safety, was more important than sometimes your literal life. And so kind of that message that's really dehumanizing, that doesn't see the individual person, but that really elevates the rigidity of the rule, which is another means of power and control. It always goes back to power and control. So those being kind of two main experiences. And then there's also one that I think is probably going to play a big role in those situations that you mentioned earlier, that the stigma that can happen with this. And there's victim blaming is very common in any type of abuse. But when you, again, say, God is upset with you. God wants you to stay quiet. God just wants you to pray more. Those kind of things, then it really, the stigmatization is hyped. It can be amplified as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see a lot of that in the two cases that we'll talk a little bit more about here in a second. But I really want to kind of lay the groundwork for, you know, what it is we're even looking at. So specifically, how does spiritual abuse typically manifest in charismatic or evangelical church settings like those that we're about, you know, about to talk about within the Vineyard movement?
You know, one of the things I like to say is that spiritual abuse, religious abuse, I don't know if this matters to your audience or even to you. I tend to use the term religious abuse more than spiritual abuse because I tend to look at organizations and systems and kind of what happens in them, and that spiritual abuse is actually kind of that third category, whether you're using the spiritual to abuse. But in the world and even in the counseling world, they're all used interchangeably. So I don't want you to think I'm contradicting you when I default to religious abuse, that's just what I'm used to saying. So, but it can happen in any system. And so I'd always like to clarify that no system is above reproach, and it can certainly, and there are certain characteristics of some organizations that make it a better breeding ground, so to speak, for this to happen. So systems that have kind of absolute authority, where authority is not allowed to be questioned, where you're expected to have blind faith. You know, patriarchy is really built into those systems that you mentioned there. And so that's another aspect that I think makes it just the internalized silencing that happens to so many people in that system, I think, is one of the things that makes it easier for abusers to coerce someone to stay silent in those systems. So those are the things that come to mind. There's, again, we could talk about this all day, but those are the things that jump out to me to start with.
Yeah, one of the things that really popped out in what you just said was one of the common characteristics between both situations, you know, the one in Anaheim and the one in Duluth, is a scenario in which you've got leaders who are very charismatic, big personalities, you know, who really kind of control the space and the room, who use this very spiritually loaded language. Some of what you said earlier, you know, well, God told me this, and, you know, and if you're not on board, then you're not, you know, you're not following. You're not doing what the Spirit is, you know, is asking or telling you to do, and these sorts of things, where it's like it almost feels as if it's something that immediately shuts down any sort of question.
Yes.
Around what they're doing, because who am I to question God? You know, it's so like immediately it feels like you would back off.
Yeah. There's a lot of proactive work on the end of the leaders to keep people quiet and keep people in line. And, you know, the threat of ostracization, the threat of, you know, being outed from that system is huge. So there's a big kind of prevention work being done for people to speak up to begin with. But if someone does, ooh, that's when there's an immediate squashing of that, if possible. There's a lot of scapegoating of that person and gaslighting to try to put the blame back on that person. So yes, there's kind of that twofold. There's the let's prep the people to stay silent and in line. And when they don't, let's show other people why they don't want to do this.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, you know, of that happening within these two stories, for sure. I know this is kind of a silly question, but I feel like it needs to be asked and responded to on here. But can spiritual abuse occur even when the abuser believes that they are doing the right thing or believes that they're being led by God?
Wow, not a silly question at all. And actually a pretty, really important and big question. And of course, yes. You know, I remember when I was writing my dissertation, my dissertation chair, Dr. Craig Cashwell, that any counselors who are listening to this who've done work in spirituality will recognize that name, was what we called my auditor. And he would read through the transcripts of my interviews, and he just listened. He was looking for bias on my end for my interpretation of them. But he would read through them and kind of found himself so moved by them and just was so aware of how many of the people who were considered abusers by these people who were telling their stories would say, well, that's just good theology. I'm just doing what God told me to do. I'm just trying to be helpful. This wasn't fun for me, but I got to get people in line. So I hope we are learning as a society that good intentions do not always bear out good actions, and the harm can be done even within good intentions. So absolutely, yes, people can harm while trying to do good, while believing wholeheartedly that they are doing good and believing that they are following God's will? And it's always interesting to me, you know, I don't know that we'll ever know this answer, but when you really dig into these charismatic leaders and when they have their downfall or even before, even there's plenty who don't have a downfall, but just trying to figure out how did this happen? Were they corrupted by power or did they seek power in order to have a space to, you know, carry out these wishes? So I don't know. I don't know if people start out with good intentions and then get a little taste of power and start doing whatever it takes to hold on to that power. And I think that the answer is all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I immediately in my brain kept thinking of the chicken. Did the chicken or the egg come first? Uh-huh. Ace, was it the power of the platform, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Good question. What kinds of church structures are most vulnerable to fostering this type of abuse, either intentionally or unintentionally?
So I think, you know, as I said earlier, those that have a pretty clear hierarchical structure to where there is no questioning allowed from the bottom up, you know, it's only dictated from the top down are, you know, and I think that that's one of the reasons why when I started this research and people say, you're studying religious abuse, you must be studying the Catholic Church sexual abuse scandals. And certainly that is religious abuse. And it's so much broader than that. But I think that that's a church that, again, this could happen in any system, but that's a church that has such a clear hierarchical structure of who's allowed to question whom and where you can, what you're not allowed to do. And that breeds some silencing along the way as well. And it's such a global church, whereas most churches are not, don't have that global organized structure. So that blind following is one of the things that I think really speaks to that. Churches that have a lot of what we call spiritual bypass, and you're probably familiar with that term.
A little bit, but go on. Yeah, this is the...
It's one of the things that it's hard to describe, but you know it when you see it. So it's basically operating only at that spiritual religious level to the exclusion of the cognitive or the psychological or the emotional. So the kind of, you know it when you see it is when someone says, just pray more. You're just not praying hard enough. Or when someone is grieving to say, you shouldn't grieve, they're in heaven. You should be happy. So it really dismisses this experience of struggle, dismisses an experience of trauma, dismisses an experience of grief to where, you know, it's healthy to think you can believe two things. You can believe someone's in heaven and you can grieve and be sad that they're not with you. Like those are not mutually exclusive things, but spiritual bypass just... Oh, it's really, it's toxic positivity in a spiritual form. It's basically. Right.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the podcast before. I didn't realize that it had a particular name for it, but we call it, oftentimes we refer to it as empty platitudes, you know, that Christians love with each other.
My pastor calls it bumper sticker theology.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's the let go and let God. And not that those mantras can't be helpful or comforting for people, but it also, you just don't want to ignore the broader perspective and experiences of someone that multiple things can set in the same space.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I'm very interested to get your take on, and this is something that as I dug deeper into these stories, and even some of the ones that, you know, I did not necessarily get into in detail throughout the series, is this kind of interesting characteristic of the Vineyard. And I'm sure it's not just the Vineyard. And I've tried to make this point pretty loud and clear throughout the series is that, you know, yes, we're talking about the Vineyard, but this is not exclusive by any way, in any way, shape, or form to the Vineyard. But a lot of their churches are led by married couples or family members. And so I did a random search the other day. I was looking at 40, just randomly picked 40 Vineyard churches across the United States, and over half of them were led by married couples. And beyond that, even more concerning and well, maybe equally as concerning, is the fact that a lot of the married couples, whether it was the co-lead pastors or other members of the leadership staff, also happen to be members of the board of trustees, you know, who are supposed to sort of keep the pastor on the straight and narrow, you know. So having said that, what are the risks for conflict of interest or abuse of power when you have a dynamic or a setup or a structure like that?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I think you, I hear that. And I just like everything you said, it just got worse and worse and worse of how just in intertwined everything was. One of the things I always say is a system that can't be questioned is a really insecure system. A system that can't be questioned, and that's the whole underpinning of your podcast and the work that you do. So obviously these are systems, and to go back to those characteristics, that's also a characteristic, you know, that doesn't allow questions at all. And so that what you're describing is just a setup for insulated power that's not willing to question itself because it's going to lose the power. So you know, you're not, they can go home and have conversations, but always present a united front to the people. And so it's one of those things that really just perpetuates that power, is not being able to question, not being able to hold someone accountable. It's a really different conversation to try to hold your spouse accountable than it is to hold a coworker accountable. And not that that's fun either, but you don't have to go home and have dinner with them and go to bed with them. So that sounds very intentional. That sounds like a very concentrated dynamics of power.
Yeah, I was told by one former youth pastor that not only is it, I'm trying to think of how he worded it specifically, something along the lines of not only is it tolerated, it's celebrated as this positive thing. And yet, you know, we look at some of, and again, these are just a couple examples out of many, but the example of Duluth, where I have, stories about how Brenda and Michael would fight, you know, in front of staff, and Brenda would leave crying, and then Michael would turn and say, "All right, like, what's next on the agenda?" And they're all like, "Oh my gosh," you know, and how from a reporting perspective, you report, you know, in that case, it was reporting Jackson, their son. Well, where does that report go? Go straight to Michael and or Brenda. And one of the other reports early on from back in 2014 by a local pastor, another Vineyard pastor in the same city, you know, went to Vineyard USA, but then was forwarded back to Michael. And that report, you know, obviously went nowhere. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's kind of the circular reporting system.
Yeah. I mean, it really just assumes the best of people, that a parent's not going to try to protect their child before they try to protect someone outside. And that's a natural instinct. And so that's why it's so important to have these layers of accountability in there who don't have that same protective instinct for, I'm putting quotes around, their own, you know, because that's just such a natural instinct to protect someone before you protect the system, you know, and or to protect the system so that you can protect the person that's in your family. So yeah, it just shreds the layers of accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, that was absolutely the situation in Duluth, where you have reports coming in going to the mother. You know, when we get to the court case, when he's finally arrested, you know, almost over a decade later, you know, some of the details in the court case were just absolutely just awful. In a couple instances, there were two mothers who went early on directly to Brenda and said, "Hey, you know, your son has sexually abused my daughter," and her response was, you know, things like, "Your daughter's just seeking attention," and, you know, all this stuff. And it went nowhere. And until finally, you know, there were some victims who were brave enough to come forward years and years later. And thank goodness there was a youth pastor on staff who then took it to another pastor within the church who had enough wherewithal to say, "I can't obviously take this to the two co-lead pastors who are the parents," went around them and met with some council members. And then they made the decision to go to law enforcement and then ultimately hire Grace to come in and do a full, you know, full-fledged internal investigation. But what's interesting is, you know, I'm also getting reports that, you know, the national leadership did a couple of things that were, we'll say, mildly concerning. One was they had a longstanding pastor who has a lot of power and authority within the Vineyard, who, you know, is from my own backyard here in Columbus, call the interim pastor who had finally gotten things moving and was advising him on all the reasons why he shouldn't, or they shouldn't, I should say, hire Grace, because Grace is very victim-centric and they would have no control over the final report. Where, well, maybe you shouldn't, you know? Maybe you should just take the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Or in control.
And then the other, you know, almost equally as, or if not more concerning, it was, you know, you had another senior leader on staff recommending, and this is all in the public forum, because Duluth, to their credit, their website has a complete timeline and they have posted everything on there, including internal communications between them and the national, leadership. And one of the national leaders said on more than one occasion, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't have the Gatlins involved in the actual investigation, but they should have some say over who you hire to investigate their son. Also, Michael should probably still help guide the church, you know, forward and all stuff. It's like just blatant conflicts of interest.
That seems so obvious to you and I. And that, you know, and again, thinking back to your question about characteristics of places that are more likely for this kind of abuse to happen, you know, systems that have decided that anyone outside their system is the enemy, you know, that anyone from outside, that we've got to circle our wagons and protect inside. And any questions, so that could be law enforcement, that could be, yes, organization that, oh my goodness, they put the victims first. Imagine that. She says sarcastically, in case you don't read tone. So this idea that anyone that isn't falling within their control is the enemy. And then they breed that idea of you can't trust anyone coming from the outside in. And even as you describe that, you can hear the centering of the abuser instead of the person who's been abused. You know, you can hear the concern for that leader and that family. And the person who experienced this horrific abuse is just getting forgotten, is getting completely dehumanized in that. Whereas I would hope that we would go, how can we protect this person who was harmed in our system? How did this happen? Let's figure this out so this can never happen again.
Yeah. And instead, you see evidence of conversations where national leadership was critical of Duluth for their tone in email communications with the Gatlins, and then also went so far as, you know, against Duluth's wishes, to pay both Michael and Brenda a severance package, despite the fact that they had both resigned because they refused to participate in the investigation. It's just like, and you feel for these victims. You're like, where are the victims in all of this?
Exactly. Exactly. You see this protection for the abuser that they never had. And now they're actually now experiencing the opposite of that. You see this care and concern and people rushing to protect them, whereas the victims are just, you know, having to go through that experience and probably experience, I don't know, of course, I don't know these victims personally, but probably experiencing just a lot of stigma themselves and feeling blamed. And so it's really a bizarre phenomenon, but happens all the time.
So that's a good transition into my next question, which is, you know, what are some of the long-term psychological or spiritual effects that you've seen and people who have experienced spiritual abuse like this before?
Oh, okay. So many, you know, similar to probably a lot of the stories you've heard from people who deconstruct. But with something like this, you know, so there's the normal, and I hate to say normal because trauma is not normal, but the normal repercussions that someone would have from experiencing sexual abuse, that just all of the trauma, the depression, the possible PTSD, the impact on relationships, the impact on someone's mental health, for long-term impacts. And then there's potential spiritual impacts. You know, it's very normal for people who've experienced this kind of thing within a religious system to conflate their abuser with God, to think that this was God abusing me, to completely lose faith. And that might be a good thing for them. I'm not saying that's a bad thing if that's what they need to do in order to heal. But it can impact people's experience of, again, religion, spirituality, supposed to be a helpful thing, supposed to be a comforting thing. And so they've not only lost maybe their faith, but they've maybe lost their community. So they're grieving. They've maybe been ostracized by their community. It's a very complicated grief of being put out of a system that they maybe don't want to be a part of, but still wanted to have some say in that choice. It's very disempowering. So there's lots of both religious impacts long term, but also mental health impacts.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who have been harmed and still sort of have that desire for some sort of spiritual community, what does healing look like? Is reconciliation with a faith tradition even possible at that point?
So another great question, and it's a big it depends answer. There's no one answer for any of that. So even from the people who wound up in my study, there was, you know, some of them who exited faith completely, exited religious systems completely, exited religion completely. One of my participants described herself as an evangelical atheist. She just was, she just really nothing to do with any of it. And that was really healing for her. Many people, though, go on and see their faith change and evolve and maybe find a system that feels healthier, that feels safer to them. Some people struggle and kind of never quite find their community, never quite find, but want that, but just can't find it.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
I hope that healing looks like finding a counselor that is able to understand this and not cause more harm, because unfortunately, just like there's a lot of power in religious systems, there's a lot of power in a therapist chair that sometimes is not always used for good, especially from people who don't understand how deep this is and what a part of people's identity this can be. So I hope that generally speaking, counseling is helpful. I've heard many stories where it is. So that's a little bit of what can be healing, but it's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah, and I can say that of the folks that I've gotten to speak with, have not spoken with any of the ones that were on the receiving end of the sexual abuse, but of the ones who were absolutely in the thick of the spiritual abuse, the manipulation by some of these leaders. So far, every single one I've spoken with has mentioned that they've gone to therapy, they've been in therapy. I was like, oh, thank God, you know?
Well, and what that can do as far as the healing goes, that often doesn't happen from the system, because oftentimes what people want, and this may not be true for every victim, but what I hear a lot, what people want is just to hear it acknowledged, hear it named as abuse, you know, instead of what's been happening with the gaslighting and the blaming the victim and making you feel guilty and like you caused it, you know, having someone say what I did was wrong. So even if you don't get that from the system, which you're probably not going to get for a lot of reasons, just, you know, sometimes the unwillingness of the system to admit that it is wrong, because it would lose power if it did that. But also the legal implications of that prevents a lot of people from having those conversations. But, you know, sometimes what I hear from my clients and from some people in the research that I do is having it named as trauma is so validating. Having it named as that this was wrong is so validating, because that internalized self-blame is real.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly to that point, you know, one of the gentlemen that I spoke with who was on staff under one of those leaders recounts a story where, you know, the short version of it is basically he preached a sermon about how he doesn't like to be physically touched unless there's a good reason behind it. And shortly after that, you know, Michael, the lead pastor, in a group setting, put his arm around him and just kind of held it there. And he said it wasn't until years later in therapy that the therapist said, yeah, he's trying to project a message out there of who controls the bodies and who's in power and who's in charge there. And I could tell that just having someone say, affirm the fact that he knew that in that moment, that felt very wrong. There's something to the way he felt, you know, I think was probably relief to him.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of how the system and the leaders in the system prepare someone for abuse, is this continually undermining of trust in oneself. You know, if you can start to question whether or not, is it okay that I don't like to be touched? Is something wrong with me? You know, and so having to question that gut instinct that goes, I don't like that, and being told like, it's okay, you should like that. No, you can trust yourself and say, I don't like that. But that undermining of your trust makes it a whole lot easier to turn someone into a victim and to keep them silent later.
Yeah. Talking about sort of responses and red flags, that's kind of where I want to kind of turn. In your experience, how do institutions typically respond when abuse is reported? And what distinguishes a healthy response from a harmful one? And I know we've talked a little bit about some of those, but yeah. In your opinion or in your experience, what?
Yeah, I've done some consulting work with some churches and religious systems that have experienced this. So looking at, it's often, you know, the ones that are responding in the unhealthy ways are not the ones that are going to bring me in typically. So, you know, a healthy response being, my goodness, let's have some accountability from outside. Let's bring someone in to look at this. Let's figure out how this happened. And so we can try to make this not happen again. But even before that, centering of the people who've been harmed, a centering, and that doesn't mean shining a spotlight on them. They often don't want that spotlight, but just a recognition of these experiences here is more important than the experiences of what might happen to our institution or what might happen to the leaders in our institution. Those who immediately, sincerely go to and try to elevate the voice in whatever way that means for the victim to be shared, to be heard, to be seen, to be acknowledged, and to hear that this was wrong. So those who immediately go to, this is what's important. And again, I want to be clear, I'm not saying shine a spotlight and have them speak. When I say their voice, it's not necessarily literally them speaking and the system hearing them speaking, but just recognizing that their voice is, that their experience is what's most important. And then, yes, being willing to examine, being open to questions, taking accountability, taking feedback, you know, that openness to feedback is a really hard quality. And that's another reason why having families as the only forms of leadership, they're less likely to give really honest feedback to each other. So being willing to do that as opposed to the unhealthy responses of denying or blaming the victim or circling the wagon, so to speak, to say, we can't acknowledge this. We got to figure this out. We've got to respond in the way that makes us look the best, as opposed to, so all about perception, like not what actually happened, not that authenticity, but how does this look like? Because what are we protecting here? I think that's kind of the ultimate question that comes to me in what's a healthy response is, who does the system rush to protect? You know, is it an image? Is it money? Is it a leader? Or is it the people who've been harmed?
Yeah, and it's interesting. That's unfortunately the second time this week I've heard the term circle the wagons. The first was around my email that I sent to Vineyard USA. You know, we'll see if they respond or not. But
interesting.
Yeah, I at least want to give them the opportunity to respond, because there are some questions that they just have not yet answered that I think deserve an answer, especially from the folks who were the victims of a system that was not designed to protect victims. You know, some of those being some of the ones that I've pointed out earlier, you know, why would you pay severance to two leaders who have been accused of their own spiritual and manipulative type abuse, who pushed their son into leadership? And what's interesting is when it was originally brought forward, I mean, this is back in 2014, maybe even before that, it's not really clear, but we know for a fact that in 2014, you know, like I said, there's another pastor across town in Duluth who was a peer, who originally, and this kind of hits on a couple things he said, originally was, you know, on friendly terms, was friends with the Gatlins. And as soon as they had a difference of opinion on some theological things, he found himself on the outside and then smear campaign. And he recounted in his letter of concern to national leadership after talking to a number of other pastors that they'd experienced much the same type of behavior, where when you were in, you were in. When you were out, you were very much out.
And when you're out, you're the enemy and you're a threat. You're perceived as a threat to that system.
Which seems like, you know, we had a cult expert on years and years ago when we first started this. And I can't help but think back to some of the things he talks about. He talked about, Dr. Madison talked about some of the tactics employed by cults, which is to demonize anyone who's outside of that system. And it's very similar, you know?
Yeah, to demonize them in a way that makes every individual see them as a threat. And it's, you know, again, adding to our list of characteristics of what causes this is a little bit of that all or nothing thing is not a little bit, a lot of the all or nothing thinking. So it's either you're completely with us or you're not with us. You're completely on our side. You're part of us. Or if you're not a part of us in every possible way, if you're asking a question, then that means, nope, you can't be a part of us at all. So that all or nothing thinking that doesn't allow for any shades of gray, for any questions or internal interrogation of what's happening, and internal, like within a person or within the broader system. So really seeing all of those things as a threat.
What's interesting that I wanted to pull this up while you were commenting on that. One of the points in the new handbook that I had questions about, and I'm still waiting for my answers, but One of the questions was under, there's a list of points that you have to satisfy in order to be considered for ministry or a license to be an official vineyard pastor proposed in this new handbook. And one of them was, it's very vague, but it says they have to demonstrate a cooperative spirit with the purposes of Vineyard USA and a commitment to relational connection to Vineyard USA.
Demonstrate a cooperative spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Read the rest of it again.
Oops, here it is. So demonstrate a cooperative spirit with the purposes of Vineyard USA and a commitment to relational connection to Vineyard USA.
So not to God, not to safety, not to, you know, and I know we're here, we're reading that out of context and there could be a lot of other stuff around that. But that definitely stands out to me is that sounds like a loyalty test. You know, it sounds like a very narrow definition of what it means to be on our side. And if you're not completely on our side, then you're not allowed to be with us at all. And what helps people stay in line in a broader sense around the system is people become so identified with the system that questioning the system would feel like questioning yourself, which is also not a bad thing from time to time. But it feels like a threat, you know, not just to the system, but also to me personally, because I'm so overly identified with the system as being who I am.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I'm looking through this handbook for some of the other recommendations that were made by both Guidepost and Grace, just in regards to preventing abuse and those sorts of things. And really, that's the main one that they seem to have honed in on was formal ordination. What was very interesting to me, and I suppose ultimately it doesn't matter in which order it comes, but it just was interesting that it was so far down the list. But you have all these different bullet points in there or different points that, again, that they have to satisfy. And then you get all the way to the bottom and it's background check. I'm like, should that be first? Might eliminate some of your candidate pool.
None of the rest of this matters.
Yeah. Yeah. If they don't satisfy the background check, then the rest of these are null and void. So it seems like that one should be number one, but you know, at least it's on.
That's the outside thing that is that could be the threat and that could kind of wipe all that away. So when you have that mentality of this one thing can topple the whole thing, that makes sense that it's kind of an afterthought.
Yeah. So many former vineyard leaders say that they raise concerns to national leadership, as I've kind of mentioned before, and were met with silence or spiritualized deflection. So like I said, sort of the spiritually loaded language, they're like, well, all in God's time. I've heard that one. Or, you know, this is what the Holy Spirit is moving us to do. And so therefore, no questions.
Spiritual bypass.
So, you know, we've kind of talked about this throughout, but like, why is that response so common and so damaging?
So why is the response of this is all in God's time so damaging? Or,
yeah,
you know, it's really, you know I jokingly said spiritual bypass, but it is kind of allowing this hands off, not my fault, not our fault. This is just what God's doing, that it absolves anyone from accountability there. And it also puts someone who questions that in the position of questioning God, as opposed to questioning this abuse that happened, as opposed to questioning, like, maybe this wasn't right. If you can just say, well, this was all in God's time, or this will all happen in God's time, you just need to be patient. It puts you in the position of you're questioning God. And so you're, again, on the outside, causing problems.
Yeah. Yep. How do movements that emphasize, you know, this kind of goes along with the same lines, but like hearing from God or being led by the Spirit sometimes create an environment where dissent is seen as rebellion? Because rebellion has definitely been a word that has popped up amongst some of these stories where I've talked to these pastors where just, you know, by virtue of asking questions and saying, hey, perhaps we didn't handle this as well as we could have, or why did we do this? The term rebellion has been used in those contexts.
So, sorry, this is an aside. It's not what you ask at all, but I'm just thinking of what a rebel Jesus was. So
absolutely.
Why is that seen as such a bad thing if you are following Jesus, if you're causing some problems? And the most criticism that Jesus had was for religious leaders, not for people asking questions.
That's a good point.
So having heard that, can you ask the question again? Because I got too caught up in that.
Yeah, I think just sort of that environment where, you know, the movement is very heavy on what the Spirit is doing. So being led by the Spirit, how does that sometimes create an environment where dissent is kind of viewed as rebellion?
Yeah. So, you know, I say this wanting to be respectful of everyone's individual faith and process as well. And so this is not something that happens for everybody, of course, but the thing that happens when people are claiming to hear the voice of God is what happens when someone hears God say something different? What happens when God's telling you one thing, but God's telling me one thing, but especially what happens when God tells you to tell me one thing? You know, who gets to decide that? And so I think that that is where the real harm can happen when there's no pathway for someone to discern. You know, they just have to accept what someone in an assigned leadership role says God says. And so when people are not allowed to discern for themselves what that means, and it doesn't fall in line with what's been told to them.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the other things that we talk about too on the podcast, we touched a little bit on, I think, on I believe the third episode. We'll see. Not fully done editing yet, so it could be three or four. I don't know. But in either case, we try to, you know, I try to do a good job of setting the stage for how the system was set up in a way that would allow for these types of things to happen. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about nepotism and the issues with sort of leadership structure and that sort of thing. One of the other things that I thought was really interesting that I tried to break down in that episode is also the rate of growth. And so, you know, the short version of Vineyard history is it. Born like a lot of non-denominational movements out of the Jesus movement of the 60s and 70s and early 80s, you know, had a very charismatic leader who was actually a musician with the Righteous Brothers originally. So really funny guy.
Fun fact.
Very charismatic, had a distinct vision and really was into sort of church planting. And they took on that identity and also coupled with, you know, really Vineyard being sort of the pioneer movement in terms of producing new worship music. And so the Vineyard publishing arm, you know, made a lot of money in the early, you know, the 90s to the early 2000s. And that in turn kind of cycled back around to fund some of the church planting and things that they did. But along the way, a couple things that occurred is you've got now famous worship leaders. And, you know, in this sort of growth mindset that developed, you also have pastors who are being put on the map because, you know, they're taking a church from, you know, 50 members to 2,000. And so this is a common thread between the two instances that we looked at, we look at throughout this podcast series. The Gatlins had a very thriving church from all, like, outside perspective. And when you look at the metrics, same thing with the Scots, who, you know, in effect took over the Anaheim, the flagship church, and pulled it out of the Vineyard. Same deal when they started in Northern Ireland, same thing. But I think the saying was like they took the church from 60 to like 3,000 or something crazy. And definitely put themselves on the map. They were invited to conferences and this sort of thing. And so what role does celebrity culture, platforms, worship fame, conference circuits play in enabling spiritual abuse?
So much. So such a good question. You know, what I kept thinking as you kept describing that was how this is what happens when churches are part of a capitalistic society. Like that's just a very classic buying into quantitative numbers are what matter, you know, for this, that more people, more money, that things we can count are what matters. And so it's easy to get caught up in that. And it's easy to get excited to see that many people getting on board with what you're doing, that you lose sight of what you're actually doing. And you just start working to keep the numbers. But your question about like celebrity and fame, you know, fame is such a powerful drug. Like it is intoxicating to stand on a stage and have people look at you and affirm you and cheer for you. And, you know, it's normal to want the approval of other people. And most of us kind of experience that day to day when we go to our job and we're trying to get the approval of our boss and maybe our coworkers and maybe our family and a few people in our life. But when you stand up there and you're getting the approval of thousands of people, then it's really, I mean, that does something to your brain chemistry. It is like a drug. It's really easy to want to keep seeking that and for that to be the thing that you're seeking rather than any, you know, ministry efforts that maybe originally set you down this path. So that's part of where so you start doing whatever you can do to keep the people as opposed to the true people, looking at the individual people that dehumanize the crowd instead of seeing the individuals in there. So I think that's a piece of it. And, you know, social media, I'm not going to sit up here and rail about social media so bad, but it's given everyone the idea that they can be a celebrity, you know, that they can attain fame, that they can, that a following is what you want more than anything else in the world, because that's what leads to all this other thing. So I think it's just made that idea a lot more attainable for some people than it used to be. You know, it's interesting to think there's a lot of people who want to tell people what to think, and there's a lot of people who want to be told what to think. So there's a lot of places where you can get those platforms and get those followers.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't even think about the social media aspect of it. But so last couple questions for you. I think really in closing, like, what advice would you offer to listeners who are starting to realize that they may have experienced spiritual abuse but aren't sure how to name it?
Keep asking the questions, first of all, because if you did experience it, you were probably conditioned to not ask questions. You were conditioned to not be willing to think that what happened to you might possibly be wrong. You know, we really may have just sounded like I was criticizing social media, but we are living in an age where we can find community in ways that you can find other people who've had your experience on social media. And so if you start seeking things out, start searching on the internet, start asking questions about just spiritual abuse, you can find other people who've had your experiences. And be careful, because there's a whole wide world out there of experiences that, you know, the way people handle this can also be quite toxic. But so ask the questions. Know that it's okay to leave a system. It's okay to stay in a system. There's no one way to handle this. If that's an important part of your community, then, you know, there's no right or wrong way to go about healing around this. You know, all the tenets around deconstruction is really important to be willing to. I've heard people ask the question, one of the things that's healing for a lot of my clients is to ask the question to distinguish between religion and spirituality, that, you know, religion can be an organization and the spirituality a very common concept is just a connection with something bigger than yourself. And so it is possible to maintain some semblance of spirituality without being part of an organization. And I think some people don't know that, even though that might seem kind of obvious, don't know that they can leave a system without leaving every part of their faith behind. You know, deconstruction is about examining different parts. I often use the analogy, I'm sure people have used this on your podcast before, of a Lego house, where you heard that one before, where, you know, so some people's deconstruction looks like just coming in and wiping it out completely all at once and walking away from it and never looking back. Sometimes it's taking it apart piece by piece and examining it and putting it back or taking it out. Sometimes it's wiping it out and then looking at it and rebuilding something completely. So giving yourself time for whatever it means to examine what's happened to you and what aspects of your spiritual life have been helpful that you want to keep and what are not helpful to you and you don't want to keep anymore and you don't have to. And it's a continuous unlearning of things. You know, one of the things so hard for people as they deconstruct is to let go of the idea of being right. And that's another system that breeds the potential for spiritual abuse, is when you've been told, everybody wants to be right. We all want to be part of the group that's right. And so letting go of that idea that you can start to ask some questions, and letting go of the idea of being right can be helpful, but that can also create a major existential crisis along the way. To keep seeking support while you go through it, that it can get better.
Now you're talking our language over here. So last question for you. What safeguards should every church have in place, regardless of denomination or no denomination, to protect people from spiritual or psychological harm?
So, you know, there are specific policies that you can go through, programming, you know, Grace, I know, is one of those that has specific things you can do to put in policies in place and to have safeguards there, you know, that kid or teenager is never alone, which is one adult, is a great policy to have in place. So there are specific things you can do and programs you can do. And I would encourage every system to do that, to have an outside company or accreditation of some sort, credential, telling you that you have gone through training to know how to safeguard not just the kids, although those are certainly one of the most vulnerable populations, but everyone in your church. And then more broadly than that, just a continuous examination of the culture of your church. Is it something that does allow a variety of opinions? Or is it something, a place that people are threatened by questions. And if it's a place where the leaders are threatened by questions, then that's probably not the healthiest place. So, you know, my church allowed us to do a whole series on religious trauma. And so, you know, because I think that churches should be the ones asking these questions and saying that this happens. So being willing to ask these questions and creating safety around them. You know, it's something I do similar. I'm not a pastor, but I'm a professor. And so when a student comes to me and ask a question advocating for themselves, the first thing I try to say is, I'm so glad you're advocating for yourself. I'm so glad that you're speaking up to make it safe for them to do that, for them to know that even the department chair can be questioned. You know, you can ask a question. I'm not threatened by that. I want to, your feeling safe is more important than me being insecure about being questioned. So kind of continuously examining the culture around that is really important.
Yeah, that's really good. And, you know, and it we won't necessarily get into this here, but, you know, it's kind of interesting to see in the aftermath of something like a huge, you know, scandal like what occurred in Duluth, to see what actions actually are taken and how quickly those actions are taken. And so, you know, these allegations first came around in 2022, 23, and here we are in 2025. To a lot of the victims, they haven't done enough. And one of the sort of shocking things that I came to find out is, so they set up a third-party reporting mechanism, and so it goes to Guidepost. But then I come to find out from senior pastors that, and then Guidepost just turns around and forwards it right to senior leadership. And I'm like, like, have we not learned anything here, guys?
Wow. It's this loop that just always circles back internally that does not create safety and does not make someone want to come forward. I could say a lot about that, but it makes me think of, like, a lot of pastors have when we ask about what churches can do, a lot of pastors have a rule in place that they will provide counseling, pastoral counseling for three times, and then they'll refer out to someone else because they want an outside opinion. They want someone to get help beyond what they feel like they can offer and to offer a voice outside of that. A healthy system will do that. An unhealthy system will say, don't you dare go see a counselor. You can only get help inside here. It always has to return to me. I have heard people say, you know, pastors say, you can only talk to me about your marriage. You can't talk to anyone else. And so anytime there's that insulated, the outside world is a threat, that is a big red flag.
Yeah, I've referred to that before in some other circumstances, like this weird tension between, you know, God's law and human law, where, you know, we can't have a little bit of both. Really, like, the context that, you know, that I heard this in was like, well, they didn't call the cops when a sexual assault took place. And they're like, well, if we do that, there's no room for forgiveness or grace for the perpetrator. I'm like, we can forgive him after he pays, like, you know, like, goes through the justice system. You know what I mean? Like, you can do both.
Yeah.
Forgive him once he's behind bars for what he did. You know,
we could do a whole podcast on forgiveness and the spiritual bypass that is, and how that's manipulated so often, and how this idea that forgiveness is an event, not a process, and that it means it's okay that it didn't happen. And lots of forgiveness is weaponized so much.
Well, you definitely have to come back. This was an incredible conversation. I really appreciate it. You're the first expert that we've had come on to talk about spiritual abuse, and which is kind of silly on my part, having done this for a decade and not done this before now, because so many of the people who listen, at least to the Deconstructionists, because I know we'll be having this posted on both channels, but so many people who find themselves in a deconstruction found themselves there because of some sort of substantial event in their life, which often was unfortunately negative. And so, you know, some of us, like myself, just found our way here through sheer curiosity. But I'm not, you know, obviously, you know, like, I know for a fact that, like, a lot of people weren't so lucky, you know, and they found
sure.
by way of trauma. So I appreciate you coming.
And a lot of people experience harm because they dared to deconstruct.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And lost their entire communities.
Deconstructed because they were harmed, or harmed because they deconstructed. Yeah.
Well put. Well, you are welcome back anytime. This is an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it and am just glad to be a part of it.
Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed in this interview are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any organization mentioned. This conversation is intended for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal, psychological, or medical advice. listeners are encouraged to use discretion, especially if they have experienced religious or spiritual trauma. Some content may be triggering for survivors of abuse. If you need support, please seek guidance from a licensed professional or trauma-informed organization. All individuals and entities discussed are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.